at KBOO. I want to thank all of the listeners and all of the callers. And now we'll move on to Pacific Underground, I believe.
There comes a time when every second, every day, when every action, every thought will tell the world how you cast your vote.
On Friday, February 3rd, 2017, from 8 p.m. until 10 p.m., from the grassroots, where we agitate for social change with music and commentary, we'll agitate with the music of Frankie Beverly and Maze. Local and national political commentary provided by Landon Crowell. We will review Mayor Ted Wheeler's first 30 days in office. And musical analysis provided by our art historian, Diane Johnson. From the Grassroots on 90.7 FM, KBOO in Portland.
This is Love Jones, producer of the world-famous Confessional. This year, Contessa de la Luna brings you a real bona fide Wild West jamboree and variety show. We've got live performances by Contessa de la Luna and Courtney Vondrell from Three Leg Torso, plus audience lasso contests, sock puppet theater, surprise fun box drawing, many other prizes. We've got performances by the Sea Charms and a selfie booth with Contessa de la Luna. We've got plenty of surprises and fun in store, so mark your calendars Thursday, February 9th, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. All proceeds benefit KBOO, your community radio station. Tickets are available now online at ContessaWestern.BrownPaperTickets.com or at the door the night of the event. Get your hat, get your spurs, and come on down Thursday, February 9th at the Clinton Street Theater starting at 7 p.m. Contessa de la Luna's Wild West Jamboree, an old-time variety show.
And this is KBOO Portland. It's 9:02 a.m. Coming up on Pacific Underground, we discuss the effect of the immigration order on Asian and Pacific Islander communities, plus a look back on problematic pop culture favorites like Short Round and The Karate Kid. Let's get right to it.
Good morning. You're listening to a special bonus episode of Pacific Underground, the only radio show produced by and about the Asian American experience here in Portland, Oregon. Today, we're going to be talking about immigration and how communities are moving to protect those who are vulnerable. First, we interview immigration attorney Diana Fakrai to talk about what people are facing when traveling in and out of the United States right now, especially people who you know, fall in that kind of zone where they're being detained and there's so many questions. So she's here to answer those questions. Then Romeo Sosa, Executive Director of Voss, talks to us about community organizing and resistance in the face of anti-immigration policies. And we'll also be taking a look, Tabitha went all the way over to the Oregon Nikkei Legacy Center where they let us have a special preview of their latest exhibit, Yellow Terror, where they are showing the art and collection of anti-Asian propaganda back in the day of Robert Shimomura. So Tabitha, Tabitha, how, just real quick before we get on the phone, get started about our immigration, how was that exhibit, getting that special preview? Was it kind of heartbreaking / inspirational?
Well,
that's what I imagine.
My reaction to a lot of anti-Asian propagandist art is just to laugh, because just to think about how ridiculous like old racist notions about Asians and Asian Americans were like. So for me, it was but it was also very thought-provoking and very interesting. And it was a collection of Roger Shimomura's artwork as well as things from his personal collection.
Well, thanks for going there, of course. So let's see. Do we have Diana on the phone? Are you there? Can
I'm
you
here.
Hear? Good morning, Diana. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for being with
Good
us.
Morning. Thanks for having
Hello.
Me.
Hello.
You know, for our listeners, why don't you give us a little information about yourself?
I'm an immigration attorney. I've always worked mostly in immigration. In 2007, I graduated law school and have been an immigration attorney since. And I received my inspiration from working at a nonprofit in San Diego, where I worked mostly with the Violence Against Women's Act and with refugees. And so after law school, I knew that's what I wanted to practice, and I've been practicing ever since, first as a nonprofit, and then now I have my own firm.
So in the last hour of our show on the show Positively Revolting, they also were speaking about immigration, but they were largely going over sort of the larger political implications. And so I'd really love for you to talk about what's going on more on the personal side for the individuals that are traveling in and out of the United States. And, you know, there's been all these rumors about detention and deportation. And one thing... you know, that I really wanted to talk to you about was about green card holders and the possibility that they are being coerced to relinquish their green cards. Can you talk about that?
Sure. Well, the first thing I want to say is everyone's afraid. Even if you're not from these seven countries, most immigration attorneys will tell you, nonprofits will tell you, the phone has been ringing off the hook. People from all over the world are afraid with what is going on. Now, what's happening at the airport specifically is that last Friday, a week ago, President Trump signed in the executive order, and it was basically making good on what he promised, which was the Muslim ban. And people who were flying in or mid-air just landed, many people got caught up in this, and they were being detained for hours and hours and hours, some we think up to 30 hours. The problem is they're not, records have not been released. So Freedom of Information Act has been filed in order to find out what really happened in these airports. But we know people were detained for hours, some were handcuffed, not given access to their phones, not allowed to call their loved ones. Loved ones were waiting in the airport, and basically attorneys and advocates were walking through the airports looking for distraught families to figure out who was back there. People ended up, some people were released, but many, they think at this point over 60 people signed and relinquished their green cards or visas and went back to their home countries. Mm. Now, these are not just people who are here with visas, but these are also people who are green card holders. And they signed a form, it's called a 407, basically relinquishing their right to have their green card, went back, and this was done, we believe, under duress, under threat, under being told if they didn't do this, they would possibly face a 5-year ban. This is not a form that should ever just be signed, you know, and taken lightly. This is normally done in front of, you know, an official. This is normally done with a lot of, you know, seeking legal advice. So it's really distressing for us to hear that. I have personally never heard of this ever happening,
so,
except for the past weekend.
What happens if someone signs one of these forms under duress? Are they able to get their green card back? Is there any sort of legal recourse that they can take?
There is. There was a man the other day, an Iranian man, who did come back. He was actually greeted at Los Angeles Airport by Mayor Eric Garcetti. And he returned after having signed one of those forms and relinquishing his green card, because immediately advocates, his immigration attorney, everyone was behind him trying to get him back here. So there is, right now, I think with the way it's heightened in the news and everyone is knows what's happening, and there's such a positive, so many positive protests out there and people know their support, I think it's easier for them to come back. Now, is it always going to be that way? I don't know. Are there still people out there that we probably don't know who have been sent back? Yes. So my advice is, if you are flying in, you do not sign those forms. And this is not just if you are flying into an airport. This is if you are an undocumented student or an undocumented person and you are at your house. If ICE comes to your house ever, they present you with a form. Do not sign it. Never sign until you've consulted with an immigration attorney, until you have someone present who you feel understands the law and can aid and assist you. Because once you sign, you are giving up your rights. Are there methods that we can help to reverse those? Sure, but it's best not to sign.
And one thing I think that surprised a lot of people was that people who were being detained at the airports were not allowed to seek legal counsel. So can you talk a little bit about that, why they weren't able to seek counsel because of their status of being at the airport and not actually having been let in yet?
Legally, when you come to a port of entry of the United States, you are not guaranteed the right to an attorney. Now, however, if you go to a website, for example, the ACLU website, they will give you advice and tips on how to speak to a Customs and Border agent. And what one of the pieces of advice is that you should never feel you need to answer questions beyond the scope of immigration. So even if you get there and you, yes, once again, are not guaranteed the right to counsel, you should still request counsel. And you should be prepared that they will be able to look through your laptop and phone. And case law seems to permit that people can make photocopies of what is on your laptop and phone, at times even confiscating it for long periods of time. So I would be careful about whatever you have with you that you would want to keep private. I would still request an attorney multiple times. I would request an interpreter if you don't understand what's happening, and I would not sign anything once again. So yes, with port of entries in the United States, that is the law, that you are not guaranteed the right to counsel, but you should still request it.
And Diana, does the Fifth Amendment apply to people who are undocumented? And what are some of the falsehoods that you commonly hear about from ICE agents and other officials that are detaining people and trying to get them to disclose information they don't need to disclose or sign away their rights?
Well, you know, the Constitution believes in due process for all, citizen or non-citizen. So when you are here, you have constitutional rights. And one thing that people don't seem to realize is that you don't have to disclose information that you don't want to disclose. Now, do they typically expect you to answer, you know, questions regarding your immigration status or why are you here? Why are you here? What are your plans for here? Are you here with, you know, for work, for, do you live here? Yes. But beyond the scope of that, you are not required to answer anything. Whether you are a green card holder, a citizen of the United States, a visa holder, undocumented, you are, you know, there is a scope of what they may ask. And while I know this question is to the airport situation, I also want to say that, you know, one of the pressing issues under the Trump administration is the DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. And many of the DACA students are also worried about what will happen. Will they even be able to get domestically on a plane anymore if DACA is not renewed? So that will be something I believe we'll be talking about later in a podcast. But I would like to give them also, you know, tips on how to handle a raid if somebody comes to your house.
Yeah.
Somebody comes to your house, same thing. Do not open the door. Ask for a warrant. Make sure it's signed by a judge. You don't have to speak to them. Ask for an attorney. Do not sign anything.
So once, if somebody is detained by ICE, at what point will someone be able to seek counsel, and will they be given counsel if they can't afford it?
No, you won't be given counsel if you can't afford it. In criminal cases, whether you're documented or undocumented, everyone has the right to counsel. And if you can't afford one, one will be provided for you. That is when you receive a public defender. However, for immigration court, attorneys are not provided, which has really come under scrutiny because sometimes we see people in immigration court who are children. So can you imagine a child is there? A child can't represent themselves. A child can't answer for themselves. So that has really come under a great deal of scrutiny, depending on who you speak to. So you are guaranteed to go in front of a judge. If you want to, if you're in a detention center, you are given a day in court. And that is something that you will meet with an ICE officer before, an enforcement and removal officer, and you can let them know, I want to see a judge. No, I will not be signing. I want to see a judge. And I would also encourage people to reach out to a local nonprofit. Catholic Charities does many Know Your Rights programs in detention centers, also Clinic, ACLU, NILC. All of these would be great places to reach out to if you or a loved one is in detention.
And you're getting back to these.
And one thing I would quickly like to say about the airport, too, is that many of these people, we are realizing, were not asked before they were turned around to their home countries the common questions of asylum, if they fear to return to their home country. And that is a violation. If that is true, that is a violation by the Customs and Border Patrol. They are supposed to screen for asylum applicants before they send people home to their home countries.
So if these questions aren't being asked, you know, getting back to these ports of entry, just to give some advice to people who are traveling here into the United States, and if they are seeking asylum, what kind of advice would you give them if they're not being asked these questions? Is there wording that they can give to make it clear that this is what they're seeking?
Well, I read a story this morning, and it relates to Oregon, of a young girl a few months old who was coming there to receive heart surgery, and her parents have been told that their visas are not no longer valid and they need to reapply, and now they're trying to do a humanitarian visa. So I'm not sure how many people are getting on planes from these countries at this point, but if you are able to get on a plane, we are advising as immigration attorneys for people at this point not to travel if you can. But if you have no choice and you do travel from one of those seven countries, I would definitely let your loved one know that you are coming, have a support system ready for you at the airport. When I land, I would call right away and let them know I was there. Once again, when I get to the inspection, I would make sure that I have nothing with me that is private that I don't want people looking at. And then I would have my loved ones contact an immigration attorney or a local nonprofit and not sign anything. Not sign anything, ask for an interpreter, and make sure that I understand what's happening. And if I don't, make sure to ask for clarification and not feel obligated to answer questions that I'm not comfortable with.
Is it within someone's right to ask for an interpreter?
It is within their rights, and one should be provided, because if you think about the fact that people were signing Form 407, relinquishing their green card, having no idea what the form says, I believe that's, you know, an incredible violation of our due process.
You know, we had spoken earlier, and you had mentioned that you were actually going to be meeting a client of yours, or maybe it was a relative of a client at the airport, even though you know you can't meet somebody should they need counsel, but that you were going to be meeting at the airport anyways, just in case, to show support and to be support for that family. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, we know there's someone flying in March who is a green card holder. She's been a green card holder for over 11 years and an elderly woman. She's afraid. And I will be at the, but she insists that she needs to fly in. And she's hoping, as we are, that this will not no longer be a problem by then. However, I don't know if that's, if anything can be taken care of in this amount of time. So I will be meeting her at the airport ready just in case she is detained. I will be there. Her family will be there. And if need be, we will have other advocates on the ground. I'm letting the mayor's office, our Los Angeles mayor, Eric Garcetti, I've sent them an email letting them know that she's coming, just because we have to be out of an abundance of caution, especially for an elderly woman or elderly man. Be careful about the fact that if they are detained for long periods of time, if they have any health issues, how could this affect their health?
And if this person is detained, what is it that you personally or someone that's in your line of work that is an attorney and knows immigration law well will be able to do for them?
Well, I have to say the one thing I would like to really commend people on is the protests. As you know, in many of the places, lawyers were not let in, but the protesters were there. And I think that gave such an incredible power to the cause. So I, you know, the first thing I would do is make sure people know that this person is being detained. I would get it out there on social media, let people know. I would also demand that the Customs and Border Patrol officer see me. Whether or not they choose to, that's their choice, but I would still be there with my notice of entry of appearance as attorney, there to meet with them. It's important that we are still there as advocates. They know we are there. They know we are there. I would, and then of course the advice I would have given her would be the same advice. The advice I have given her would be the same advice I've given to you and your listeners, of not signing anything and making sure to just tell the border officer how many, you know, this is where I live. This is who I am. This is another thing I'd like to say. I always advise my clients who have green cards to naturalize, to become U.S. citizens. And for years, they would say, why? Why should I do that? I like, you know, this works for me. This works for me. You know, I think we're seeing today why you should do that.
Diana, we're all out of time here. But on the phone, we hope you can stay on the phone with us for just a little bit more. We are going to be speaking an executive director from Voss here, and he's on the line as well. But just before we switch over to that, we just want to let our listeners know that we are going to be having an extended interview with Diana. If you check out our podcast, we'll be releasing that tomorrow. We'll be doing an extended interview where Diana will be talking about the Know Your Rights orientation that she does do, and answer more of our questions to get a little bit more in depth about all of these things. So let's turn it over to Executive Director Romeo Sosa. Are you there?
Yes.
Hey, Romeo. Welcome to the show.
Hey. Thank you.
So briefly, can you describe the organization that you work for, VOS, and the role that VOS plays in the Portland community?
Yeah, BOSS is a worker rights education project. We work with day laborers. Day laborers are the people who look for work on the street corners. And also we operate a worker center we just opened 8 years ago with the help of the city of Portland. And BOSS is a key part of the immigrant movement in Poland. We create so many coalitions because the need. One is the Portland Immigrant Rights Coalition, which is about 10 organizations to fight policies that affect the life of immigrants. And we are part of the also Mayday Coalition. We are one of the key members to organize the Mayday March. and also in 2006, we were one of the organizers about against the Sensenbrenner bill, one of the anti-immigrant bill that have introduced in the Congress that criminalize immigrants and whoever helps them. And for the first time, we have about 30,000 people street marching against that bill in Portland. And also we do a lot of other things like skill training, health and safety trainings for the people who can learn more skills to get a better jobs and integrate in the workforce development in Portland.
So, Romeo, I'm not sure if you were able to listen in on our conversation with Diana just a few minutes ago, but we were just talking about when people are detained at the airport, and I realize there are kind of two issues that we're talking about here. We're talking about the executive order that bans immigrants from seven different Muslim countries, and also the executive order that targets immigrants that are undocumented and seeks to have them deported. But there is some crossover, and I think what's interesting and what's great about having both of you on right now is that Vos deals with the community organizing aspect of taking care of undocumented communities, and Diana, you deal more in the legal aspect, and you touched on how important the community organizing aspect is to create that pressure. So I was wondering if Romeo and Diana, you could offer something about just these shows of disapproval, of public outrage at what is going on here and the impact that that can have that you've seen. So Diana, why don't you start first, and then Romeo, I'd like to hear from you too.
Well, you know, I always say judges are human. So the same way that the judge saw Rudy Giuliani's comments about how this was a Muslim ban, but they formulated it in a way to make it supposedly legal. The same way they see that, they're going to see protests. They're going to see the support of the community, people out there. When the airports were flooded, it was a beautiful show of support for these people. And it was support not just for their families that were there, but it was support for the fact that people don't believe it's constitutional. People don't believe that this is right. This is not the America that we believe in and stand for. And that was very evident. So I think that there was an interview with a protester on MSNBC, and he said, "We won. Today we won," as the people were being released. And he's right. It was a collective effort. I think it's, and I hope to see those efforts continue, and it seems very much that they will be continuing.
And Romeo?
Yeah. One of the things that we believe here in Voz and among the believers, there's no one can save us if we don't organize ourselves. I think we should organize ourselves, and we have to respond from the bottom up. And we are preparing ourselves. We are organizing neighborhood committee. And we also have, we just recently have two popular assemblies that where people, they really come up with some ideas how to defend themselves, or how to create, we call defense committees in the neighborhood. And also a series of Know Your Rights training. You should know what to do when you're driving or when you got stopped or in your home, like the lawyer was mentioned, or at school, or wherever you are, and you need to know exactly what you do. And that's one of the tools that we're providing to the community, because ultimately there's no lawyer with you when you get stopped. It's by yourself, and that's some basic right that you need to exercise. And another thing that we are organizing is that a legal officer routine that we need to document any incident will happen between law enforcement and a delivery or any immigrant. and we provide trainings that what to document and what to not document. And part of that too, we have another rapid response team, because we, if you know that we hear that ICE is in at the courthouses last week, and it will continue. But this is nothing new for us, for the immigrant community. We have been persecuted under the administration, the Obama administration. They have deported more people than any other president before. They're using the technology, they use rape, and they use many different programs. Like one of the programs that have deported a lot of people is secure community that we install in jail. And so that's one of the things that we fight here in locally, that to not cooperate with ICE. We don't want secure community in jails. And finally, in 2014, they end up secure communities in jail. But they want to replace with another program they call Priority Enforcement Program, which is a replacement of secure community. And and we pressure the sheriff that to not accept that new program, and he rejected that program about 6 months ago and became the first sheriff who rejected that program from ICE. But and also we are pushing hard to make the city and the county a sanctuary, which like 3 months ago or a month ago, something like that, Tuma County declared themselves like a sanctuary. But we need to put more teeth on that, because it's just, we don't want just a symbolic thing like what happened last week. And because there is no policies, we need a concrete policy to move forward. We don't want ICE in the jails. We don't want ICE in the courthouses. We don't want ICE in the DMVs, in the hospital, in schools, in church. So we need to create more policies that to make a really a sanctuary place and a safe place for people to live. Because right now, we can just say we are sanctuary. Politician looks good, and we have the legislation there, or the, and it's just in a paper. But the reality, it's a different. There's ICE coming to our houses to detain and deport people, and you can get stopped because here you don't have a driver license, you end up in jail. So this one thing that is really serious is the cooperation between the police department and Immigration Customs Enforcement, which we believe it's two separate entities, and it's not the police jobs to ask for documentation for the people they stop. So I think the answer is organizing and respond in a peaceful way, because we don't hate them. The whatever the policies, new policies they are creating, but also we are not afraid of them. We are been survived for many years. We are responding and with love, with justice. And so we continue to do that. And like I mentioned before, we are connecting a lot of groups right now. I think I have never seen that before, that connecting Asian, African-American, American, Native American, Latinos. So we are all come together. And this is a really good thing for me to see that, to respond that to hate, to division, because for me, United States, like somebody says, it's becoming a very divided state of America. This is not the America what I have seen, and it's becoming worse, the attack against immigrants, but like I mentioned, this is nothing new.
Hmm. So Portland has sort of a history with ICE. I think in recent years, I've heard less about raids and about surveillance and this intentional targeting of people who are migrant workers or otherwise undocumented and trying to make ends meet here in our community. I know that workers working at a produce warehouse were raided, and it was, I think that was in the late 2000s. So are you seeing, I guess, what's the kind of trajectory of ICE activity in Portland, and is their presence at the Multnomah County Courthouse alarming? Is this a new thing that you're seeing?
No, this is nothing new. They've been there. We have cases of people who got detained in the courthouses. We have about two people that they called us, and one of the, it was a day laborer who got detained after they passed it. It was like a year ago. And we tried to denounce, nobody hears us. But I think it's good that this it's make more clear, like people are aware of that now. But we are trying to say things, but it seems like media doesn't pay attention to us because this thing is happening. And they use so many programs, like I mentioned. They have the presence of in the courthouses outside the courts. Also, they have detained people. And also, the secure communities programs got detained more people than anybody, any other program. The secure community is just when you get in jail, you have to be a fingerprint, and that information used to go to SBI to check your criminal record. But now that program, it goes to ICE. So immediately ICE put a hold on you if you are not in their data, if you are undocumented. So they pick you up, and that have deport so many people, but also they do individual raids. They go to their homes after they release somebody from jail, and they know the address. There is communication between other entities like courthouses. So how can they get that information after they release a person, and then 3 days later they knock to your door? So that's what it's been happening. And some of the things, in some of the times, that police are helping them to be present there. And so we have so many stories. We have a lot of people got detained for years with no reason, and we have people really we end up to stop to their deportation. So we're like a coalition that we're really seeing the many different things happen in Poland. In Poland, almost every day they have been threatened for people.
If you're just tuning in, this is Pacific Underground, and we are a radio show. We're a collective of Asian Americans that are trying to increase awareness and increase the stretch and reach of Asian American voices. And today we're talking with Romeo Sosa, who is the executive director of VOS here in Portland. Romeo, I want to talk a little bit about concrete community defense and other similar actions that involve community organizing that are being taken or that we can continue taking to help in our response to incidents like people being detained by ICE when they're showing up in court, or ICE raids at people's homes. And I just I wanted to ask you kind of just broadly about what the communications networks are. You mentioned a rapid response team. What other measures can we take?
I think push for, like I mentioned, we need to be involved in pushing our politician to make a really safe place for immigrants and any other communities, because we are all under attack. Basically, to push for specific policies that we don't want ICE in anywhere in here. But also, they need to prepare, like I think, I don't want to say again, because the lawyer says about their rights, but also they need to prepare, they need to have their own plan and the family plan. Start in the family to have a plan before a raid or before anyone get arrested. They need to have a plan during the raid, or if they're going to knock your door, if you're going to be arrested. You need to know exactly what to do with the number you need to call. So you have a time to collect all this information. And also, we need to create a network of communication. One of the things that we learned from the day laborers in Arizona, because Arizona, that your bio is persecuting them, And they organize, they call Comités de Defensa del Barrio, which is a way that in Latin America, movements, they defend themselves to blocks. Three blocks, they have like a committee that they watching if ICE comes, and they have a way to communicate each other in their houses. And every 2 weeks, they have a monthly assembly, which one of the leaders of the three blocks, they get together to give reports what's going on. And that's kind of like a similar idea we're trying to create here at the national level with the laborers. And we are getting together with other groups which they are not day laborers. Like we had this popular assembly, we invite other people to do the same thing. They need to organize their churches, their schools, and they should know what exactly to do if ICE or any hate groups, they're going to come and harass you.
And can people reach out to VOS if they want to get advice or guidelines on how to prepare for such a situation?
They can reach out. We have material. We have like Spanish material. We have kind of the experience where we just can provide them some, but training. They should. That's the idea of us when we prepare to deliver in Arizona, have experience, and they just share some ideas and create materials. And ultimately, Arizona, they're not going to come here. We have to come up with our new own way to defend ourselves. It's just some basic idea. And the key component of this is the communication. Communication and really know what to do in before, during, after a raid. But also, we need people, our ally, to document any information if ICE is going to show up. So we need to call this ally and come and document and record exactly what's happening. Mm-hmm. Because there's so many lies after when you go to the courthouse. They are more on the side of the law enforcement instead of the people. So we have evidence how to fight that back.
So I think it's widely understood in Portland that this is a sanctuary city, which I think, in my understanding, it just means that local law enforcement and city resources aren't going to be allocated towards cooperating with the federal government and federal agencies that are seeking to round up and deport undocumented immigrants. Would you say that that's actually true in practice, though? It doesn't seem like there's condemnation of ICE being at the Multnomah County Courthouse and other similar things that we're seeing happening in these past 2 weeks. But would you say that, like, you're seeing a commitment to being a sanctuary city yet in Portland?
I think one of the things, I'll be honest, that really, I think it's just a paper for me, or just a symbolic thing that was happening at the city level and the county level. Politicians, they promised not to cooperate or to make people safe in the city. But we need more concrete things that to make a really sanctuary city. But if we are really sanctuary city, ICE should not do a raid in front of the courthouse. Should not be in anywhere here. I think ultimately the immigrant community, we want ICE out of Portland, ICE out of the state of Oregon, if it's possible, out of the United States, you know. And because I think the thing is, we are not defending people who commit crimes. I think one of the things that they need to go to the criminal process, whatever they want. But the fact is that they connected with ICE, and you end up in your deportation. You can pay for your fee in jail, whatever, like anyone else. You know, mm-hmm. But the connection with ICE, with immigration, that makes a double thing, that you pay for your whatever the crime is, but at the same time, you are in danger to be deported. And like I said, we need to push more for concrete policies, and it's not, for me, it's not just symbolic thing. And I think I want to thank the politician also in this moment, like, stand up and say, and speak up. Like they say, we are with you, but we want to make sure concrete things, how can you be with us like some of the communities, is the mayor come to with our house when I was resting, or what is that commitment? Like I think policies at least in place make a safe place for us to live.
So Romeo, we're gonna have to leave it there. We've run all out of time. But really, I really deeply appreciate you joining us on the show. Thank you for taking the time to do so.
Yeah, no problem.
We'll connect with you later. Take care.
So that was Romeo Sosas, Executive Director of VOS. And early we were speaking to Diana Fecre of Hobson, Bernardo, and Davis, an immigration attorney with offices in Los Angeles, San Francisco, and Washington, D.C. Next, we're going to talk about something that's happening here locally, a local event that is being, it's an art exhibit being held at the Oregon Nikkei Legacy Center. And Tabitha Teo, our very own art curator in-house, had a look at that exhibit. Tabitha, why don't you tell us what you saw and what's going on?
So you, Jenna, were actually the one that told me about this exhibit, and I thought it sounded really interesting, and you connected me with Lucy Capehart, who is the director of collections and exhibits at the Oregon Nikkei Legacy
Center.
Thank you. There are four words I hate.
And what is the name of the exhibit again?
It is called Yellow Peril, or Yellow Terror, the Collections and Paintings of Roger Shimomura. See, now you have me started on the Robert.
Sorry. But, Yellow Terror.
Roger Shimomura, he's an Asian American artist, and he is inspired by the pop art style, and he focuses... these paintings are, I guess, his take on racist, propagandist representations of particularly Japanese Americans during World War II. And at the exhibit, I believe there were four paintings by him. But he's also an avid collector of racist propaganda, World War II era, and earlier artwork, and those were also those are part of his private collection. And like I said earlier, when I saw these things, I just kind of had to laugh, because as the saying goes, if you don't laugh, you cry. And
oh, so much truth in that statement.
And yeah, and so my reaction was to laugh, because these are really damaging and incredibly racist and painful depictions of Japanese Americans. Part of Roger's collection is he found Japanese hunting licenses that were called Jap hunting licenses.
Like they were literally licenses to go out and kill Japanese people.
They were propagandist pieces.
That's terrifying.
Yeah. And there was one, it's in the exhibit, but there was one that had like a Japanese person's head like mounted on like how you mount a deer head.
Jesus.
Oh my God. Yeah. And then there was a button that said that this person that had the button was able to issue Jap hunting licenses. Well, luckily, we have Lucy Capehart on the phone to talk about the exhibit. Lucy, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Excellent. Thank you for joining us today. So tell us about the planning of this exhibit and how you started and how long it took to get the exhibit at the Oregon Nikkei Legacy Center.
Well, actually, interesting enough, the exhibition was in support of a grant we have from the Collins Foundation to write a curriculum. We're writing a curriculum for Portland schools on media literacy, Japanese American history, and propaganda. So it started out, you know, just as a support of that grant, and little did we know how appropriate it would be for these times. So that was 2 years ago. So now here we are in 2017, and And the work has not only will help our curriculum, but also I think it's very good for Portland citizens to see this kind of how this kind of racial prejudice prevails. And this is a good example of how, you know, this kind of thinking, stereotypic thinking, can enter into even private lives, such as having racist ashtrays and board games that are Japanese soldier targets, that kind of thing. So it's really interesting, and I think for these times, it's incredibly apropos. But yeah, that Nikki and Dama, our mission is to promote understanding of the Japanese experience. So this really fit in to our mission, the show. Because Roger Shimomura actually was interned in Minidoka, one of the camps. So he has an incredible perspective on all this.
Wow. Yeah. You told me that Roger was interned at a camp. That's pretty amazing.
Mm-hmm. He must have been very young when he was interned, then, I imagine.
He was very young, yes. But he remembers it, you know, quite well. But yeah, he was really young.
Yeah, it just seems, an impression on him that would have made, especially as an artist, to have that be such a fundamental part of your upbringing.
Yeah. And he, a lot of his earlier work dealt with that, being in the camps, and there were images of barbed wire and, you know, people behind fences and that kind of thing. So, yeah, he's quite, I think he really tries to educate the public about, you know, Japanese American history, and to let people not forget what happened.
Before we run out of any time, I just want to make sure that our listeners get all the details about this exhibit. So how long is it going to be running?
Okay, it's actually a very long run. It's February 5th to July 16th. And so you have plenty of time to see it. So, and we are at, I don't know if you already mentioned this, but we're at 121 Northwest 2nd downtown. And our hours are Tuesday through Saturday, 11 to 3, and Sunday, noon to 3.
And is there a website or any place people can go to find a little more information?
Yeah, there's a website, Oregon Nikki Endowment, definitely. And I also wanted to mention, if we have time, this is the 75th anniversary of the Executive Order 9066, which was the order that authorized Japanese Americans to be put into the internment camp. So we're having a commemorative celebration at the Portland Assembly Center on May 6th, which will be, it's called Return and Remember, the Pilgrimage to the Portland Assembly Center. So that would be something that might be interesting to check out.
And for maybe our listeners who don't know our local history here in Portland, Portland was one of the cities that had Japanese Americans, the whole state of Oregon had Japanese Americans interned. And one of the centers that people were sent to assemble at was at our local centers here. And that date, May 6th, is the day that supposedly Oregon became Japanese free, meaning no more Japanese people in the city. And so that is the significance of that day. And I guess the Japanese people will be returning on that day to make sure everybody sees that they're there. We're just about out of time here for our phone call, but we'd really like to thank you for joining us. Tabitha, you have anything?
Yes.
And I wanted to say that this is an exciting show that you should check it out. It's really amazing.
Yeah. Thank you for letting me see the exhibit a little early yesterday.
Sure. That was fun. Yeah.
And it certainly had an effect on me, and I highly encourage the people of Portland to check out the exhibit at the Oregon Nikkei Legacy Center.
Well, thank you for joining us, Lucy.
Sure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You know, just in talking about all this in our last few minutes here, we wanted to do a quick kind of discussion about our here on Pacific Underground, our kind of opinions about what modern day propaganda we see. I think it's easy for us to look back on that type of exhibit at the Oregon Nikkei Legacy Center, and it's so obvious, like, oh, that is really, really racist, that thing from, 70 years ago. And we have so much similar propaganda happening in our modern day society, and people don't seem to see it as racist, but I'm imagining in 70 years, they'll look back and be like, oh my gosh, I can't believe anybody played Call of Duty.
Yeah, the immediate thing I think of is the current Islamophobia that's happening right now, especially with the Muslim ban, immigration ban, and then in a lot of Hollywood movies and television shows, if there's a terrorist storyline, it's always inevitably Muslims.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's just, you know, when we're talking about like these bans and everything, it, especially when I think back on like Japanese American history, it's not as though, you know, Pearl Harbor happened and then all of a sudden there was this, you know, yellow terror, yellow, you know, fear. It was decades and decades of propaganda leading up to this. And Tabitha, I'm sure you can tell us that, you know, at the exhibit, it wasn't like all the art came from one year, right? It was like decades of art.
This most of the work was from the 30s and 40s. But even prior to that, there were so many racist depictions of Asians.
Yeah, like because of the Chinese immigration ban, right? So, I mean, the art that's at the Nikkei Center is definitely Japanese focused. But leading up to that, you had a lot of anti-Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so when we look back at our history, you're like, wow, well, when you think of like Call of Duty, to me, that is one of the biggest propaganda things we have, right? That, I mean, that started what the when you saw the Middle East being featured in those games. I want to say that was in the early 2000s.
I don't
maybe.
Play Call of Duty.
That's good. That's a good
thing. Yeah, probably middle or late 2000s. And for listeners who aren't familiar with Call of Duty, it's a first-person shooter video game where you're
in war.
You're a soldier. You have like the same point of view as if you were like fighting and you have a gun in front of you. And the campaigns, the storyline centers heavily around like being a U.S. soldier, like a special forces operator.
And Black Ops.
And you're essentially just like killing brown people that are depicted as like terrorists, I guess, or like combatants. And there's really very little humanity and very little story that's incorporated into like who your adversaries are. And it's really mind-numbing.
It's propaganda art to me when you see
it. Very propagandistic, especially when it comes to the U.S. military hardware that they feature. It's actually like it's really disturbing.
I mean, it's you know, when you see it, and then you see as the games are coming out, it's not necessarily who we're even at war with. There's I forget which Call of Duty that came out in the last couple of years where, you know, China is the enemy, and it's almost like these kind of things in our media are setting us up for, oh yeah, look, this inevitable war with China. Oh, look at this inevitable war in Pakistan and this and that. And, you know, and then, like, oh, what, the Olympus has fallen.
Oh,
where they're setting up North Korea to be our enemy.
This up. Yeah. And North Koreans are the terrorists in that movie.
And they are starting to be. And you know what's really sad about that is I was like, oh, awesome. There's actually Korean American actors in a movie. Oh, wait, they're just being the terrorists. And like that's often now how we're seeing Asians. You know, we're seeing the attack that happened on the 80-year-old woman yesterday. And then the Chinese man who is 60 years old playing Pokemon in his car, you know, killed just a couple days before. And, you know, where do these feelings come from? You know, we see it so much in our media, freaking Homeland.
Right.
Oh, Homeland.
I think, like, right now, it's far more insidious than it was back then, because instead of obvious caricatures that are just distortions, we have storylines that really distort the reality.
It justifies,
And it otherizes people, and it justifies their killing. And, you know, we have things like that are so normalized that the U.S. military has employed. Like, this was a while ago, even, you know, following 2001, there was that playing card deck that had Iraq's Most Wanted, and it was essentially distributed throughout the U.S. Army as essentially, like, hits on top Iraqi military officials, and the U.S. companies would essentially go around Iraq trying to confirm the kills of these people. And, you know, Saddam, of course, was on that deck. And it's just like having a dartboard with caricatured Japanese faces on it.
Exactly. I mean, it's just, the other thing is, you know, people are, well, that's not racist, or you know, these video games. For years I was a gamer, and, you know, try to justify to people, like, this is racist, this is propagandist art, and they say no. And then I'd say, well, you know, okay, think about it this way. Imagine playing Counter-Strike, or imagine playing Call of Duty, or watching any certain movie like White House Has Fallen, and imagine that the terrorist enemy is Canada. Okay, now everybody thinks that sounds weird and totally unrealistic. Well, this is fiction. These movies are supposed to be fiction. It's supposed to be about blowing up stuff and seeing guns. Well, if it really is just about fiction and wanting to see stuff blow up, then we should be totally fine with watching Canada, like in this fictional story, in this fictional universe, be our enemy. But no, we always have to choose people who we inevitably want to go to war with, or not we, but our government wants to go to war with, and the enemies that our government wants to push, and go, oh, look at all these brown people, and now they're even bringing back yellow terror, apparently, on our senior citizens. It's heartbreaking, and to know that some of these things are some of the highest selling video games, some of the biggest blockbusters on, I mean, you know, one of the most popular and lauded television shows right now is Homeland. And how many more, you know, Muslim people have to come out and say, this is propaganda. Propaganda art, you know, so stuff to think about. But we are, oh, look at that, we're all out of time. So thank you, Sam. He's like giving us the eye, like, you guys, we got to get off the air. So Sam, why don't you hit that outro music for us? And we will. There we go. Thank you, everybody, for joining us. So you've been listening to a very special episode of Pacific Underground. Make sure to tune in for our next show on Friday, February 24th at 11 a.m. right here on KBOO. We'll be sharing stories about life in America from an API perspective, so tune in. In the meantime, check us out online at pacificunderground.org or on the socials at PAC Underground. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes and SoundCloud. There you can find special bonus audio, including a full-length interview with our guest today, immigration attorney Diana Fucre. We'll be releasing that podcast tomorrow, so check it out. Pacific Underground is a production of KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland, Oregon. A big thank you to all of our guests today, Diana Fucre, Executive Director Voss Romeo Sosa, and Lucy Capehart from the Oregon Nikki Legge Center. Our theme music is by Chops. You can find them on Tumblr. And our engineer is Sam Parrish. Thank you, Sam.
And this is KBOO Portland. It's 10 a.m. coming up. It's Air Cascadia with headlines, interviews, and commentary brought to you by your host, Chris Andre. Followed at 10:15 with Flashpoints. And at 11, a Radio Geekly continues its multi-part series on gatekeeping and the oppression of people of color in geek culture. And thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you are not currently a member of the KBOO Foundation, you can remedy that oversight at kboo.fm. You click on the word donate. That's all coming up. Keep it locked right here on your